city of St. Louis, not in the county. I don't work in the county. And I don't work with juveniles. This is all with adults. Of course, you're considered an adult at 17 years of age. So, that, you know. And like the jail is a maximum security institution, the workhouse is a medium security institution. In fact, that's the name of it, the medium security institution. The basic difference between the two institutions is that, you know, a medium security institution, there's a lot of movement. In other words, we kind of use it like the people come to the services. In other words, we send for people, they come to us, they go to the medical, they go to chow, they go to social service. Whereas the jail, which is a maximum, there all services are brought to them. In other words, the social workers go to them, I go to them, medical goes to them. The only group activities that you have usually revolves around, well, religious activities, the worship services, the Bible classes, and then they have what they call a life skills class. They have the GED or the adult basic education, where they will go to a room, and there again, the limit, that the maximum that they'll let any inmate gathering be is 24 people. So that's, you know, the basic difference. Originally, the workhouse was, you know, brought into being for city ordinance violators. The typical idea, if you work off your fines, in other words, you were fined for some city ordinance violation. If you couldn't pay that fine, you went to a workhouse, and then you performed some public service in the city through your confinement until, you know, it was paid off. It started out as $1 a day. Later on, it was raised to $15 a day. But that is no longer in effect because it's illegal or unconstitutional to confine a poor person to pay a fine. You can't do that anymore. As long as you don't have any money, you can't get locked up for a fine. You know, you just keep going back to court until you can make a payment, or they'll dismiss it, one of the two. Otherwise, you know, and when I started, the workhouse was probably 3/4 confined people. In other words, not confined, but sentenced people. And 1/4 were pretrial. Today, it's just the reversal of that. Almost everybody we got basically is pretrial. In the city of St. Louis, it takes, on a crime against property, it takes 6 to 9 months to actually have your trial. You get a capital crime, which is usually what they consider a crime against persons, robberies, rapes, murders, and those sort of things, it takes 9 to 12 months to get to trial. So the average overall stay, not counting those people who just come in and go out, in other words, they're there a couple of days and then they get out on bond or something like that, is probably around 4 months. So it's a somewhat of a short-term institution. So a lot of crisis intervention is played and so forth and so on. My responsibilities at the jail and also at the workhouse is that I coordinate all the religious activities that go on in the jail and the workhouse, although I work together with the director of volunteers at the workhouse, but at the jail, that's all my thing. Anybody who comes in under a religious guise, as it were, in other words, clergymen coming in to visit the members, anybody who comes in for Bible classes, I have 3 people right now who are what we would call friendly visitors. They're basically Christian people who come in and visit inmates who do not get visits while they're there. I have what we call a volunteer group, which we call tier volunteers. They work with one tier primarily at the jail, where there are 12 men confined. And there they take care of their spiritual needs, their physical needs, the family needs, and they also advocate for them when they come to court in terms of sentencings, probations, and things of that nature. So those are my responsibilities, plus being at the jail 3 days a week and the workhouse 2 days a week. And then we see anybody who wants to see us. I usually get around the jail at least twice a week. In other words, everybody has access to me if they want to see me. There's no superimposed or forcing ourselves upon anybody who comes in the institution. In other words, you don't have to see the chaplain. You know, you have to see medical, you have to see social service, but if, you know, you don't have to see the chaplain. Counseling-wise is probably limited. In terms of what people mostly think of in terms of counseling, that kind of stuff probably goes on more in the penitentiary than ours. Ours is probably more of a crisis intervention, and that has to deal with the spiritual lives of the people as well as any other needs that they may have. And I run the gamut in terms of my work. It's call my mom or call my family, tell them to visit me or leave money or get me out on bond, to the other extreme is I want to talk to you about my life, which usually means, you know, I want to find out who God is or why is God doing this to me, or repentance, confession, forgiveness, and the reassuring of those kind of things. So that's kind of the gamut that we run, or sometimes you could even consider us somewhat of a religious social worker, as a way. I do an awful lot of work of advocacy in the courts, also in the system. The ombudsman program was started by me. I served as the ombudsman when it first started, half-time chaplain, half-time ombudsman. Now we have a full-time ombudsman who works with us. Also in the city, one more quick thing, and then I'll stop. I said we're going to talk, and then it'll be a monologue. The city supplies no chaplains. In fact, most cities are this way. There's a few cities that do supply chaplains, but very few. And if they do supply them, usually it's almost a token kind of payment and whatnot that they give. I think New York supplies chaplains, but it's, you know, a minimal amount of pay that they give the people. We are basically outsiders in the institutions. We're there by, you know, anytime they want to say we don't want you no more, you know, they can be put out. However, the city does supply you, usually with secretarial help, phones, office space, and things like that, in their institutions. But usually the chaplains are supplied by either a grouping of churches or a denomination or something like that. The United Church of Christ and us have chaplains at like regional, the county, we supply the chaplain there. I'm the chaplain at the jail and the workhouse. Simon Bodley is the chaplain at Truman Center and Northview Village. So those are, you know, basically supplied by us and any other public institution. Now, the state institutions supply chaplains, but not the city. So, questions?
What's the ombudsman?
Ombudsman is one who handles grievances. It's a Scandinavian term that it's like a go-between, a buffer between usually the government and the citizens. And they present their gripes or complaints to the ombudsman. An ombudsman will usually investigate those complaints. If they're valid, then they bring them to the officials, usually with suggested resolutions to the problems. However, they have no power in order to change something. But they can go and say, hey, we would recommend, you know, this is a valid complaint. It seems like it could be an individual complaint, or it could be dealing with the policy of the institution or something like that. After investigating it, and if it is valid, then we try to work up recommendations, maybe a few alternatives to, you know, how you could rectify this, and present it then to the administration, and then they deal with it. We were the first ones to have the ombudsman program in a pretrial detention facilities. So this was really a first for the country. There's a little bit to that. However, a week after we started ours, they started one in New Jersey. We just beat them by a week, but we were the first ones. And also, which was unique about our ombudsman program, is that we not only dealt with the grievances of inmates, we dealt with grievances of inmates and staff or anybody who had some grievance that centered around the jail. I mean, it could have been lawyers coming. Like the lawyers complained one time about the hours that we had about getting in and out of the jail. We looked at them, and sure enough, they were really limited, almost to just a one day when they could get in there. So we increased that, almost eliminated hours that lawyers should have access to the jail anytime that they so choose. Of course, there's feed time and visit time and things like that that, you know, nobody wants to go in there because nobody, you know, you don't have space and all those kind of things. So we handle the individual complaints, investigate them. If they're valid, then we challenge whoever, you know, is in power. Or if they're not valid, you just go back and tell them, hey, we got nothing coming. You know, it's not a valid complaint. A lot of times they can be just solved verbally. I mean, there's a lot of complaints just because of the lack of information. that you can explain things to somebody, and that suffices. Sometimes we have to go into a total investigation. It's written up. You interview witnesses and all those kind of things. And that, like we had a complaint against a warden down at the workhouse who basically beat a guy. Mm. We investigated it and came up with our conclusions. We didn't make any recommendations on it, but the complaint was valid and it was verified, and he was suspended for 2 weeks. So that probably really upped our credibility with staff and with residents, because a lot of people thought, well, it was just a whitewash, and you know, it wasn't. It was, in fact, a valid thing. I mean, if they wouldn't have done anything, well, then we would have went over people's heads then, too.
And this is the Ombudsman program is seen to be a service provided by
the Lutheran Mission Association.
The Lutheran Mission Association. That's good. That kind of helps credibility of your ministry then.
Right. And again, it's an outside thing. In other words, we're not beholden to the city. In other words, you know, we can say what we want to, like I opposed the building of a new jail and the bond issue and all that, debated with the sheriff on television and all those kind of things. And again, a lot of the administration also felt that a new jail wasn't necessary, but they couldn't come out and say it because if they said it, then the mayor would have got on their case and, you know, they would have been minus some money, probably employment. You got any questions about jail ministries or anything like that? I mean, any idea or?
I do. As far as the ministry goes, do you offer Bible studies?
Yeah.
Okay, and then come to it. The question that I have, though, is finding religion seems to be kind of convenient in jails. Is that true, or is that just a
no more convenient than it is on the street.
It isn't? Okay, because it seems to be, well, even this is pre-trial, if they have been seen to have found religion before trial, it might go easier on them when they go in. Is that
not
true?
Not necessarily.
No, okay.
In fact, actually, I think there's a lot of skepticism about that. And a lot of, I mean, it's just the idea that everybody has is that everybody who comes to jail is some form of heathen. You know, I mean, it's just like sending out a missionary. Well, that's hogwash. I mean, these people are probably, I mean, I would say 99% of the people that come into jail have got some religious affiliation in their lives somewhere along the line. I mean, either it was Sunday school or church, and most of the guys come from very religious families, usually usually Christian families. There was a big move of the Muslims some years ago, and now the Maori science is the big thing. But the Maori science, in my estimation, is nothing more than, you know, a strong-armed group, and that's predominantly in the penitentiaries. You don't find that too much in pretrial situations. We got some Muslims there, and we also have Muslim worship on Wednesday evening, where they can come, and so we try to cover all bases. We got the Muslims and the Christians, or Protestant and Catholic. You know, that's the basic three. We don't have any Jewish. We got Jewish rabbis on call. Because we get very few Jews in jail. There's been, in my term, I think we've had 2 Jews that were being confined in the 17 years that I've been down there. So, so I mean, that's limited. So there you just contact, I take that back, there's been 3. So there we just call the rabbi, and the rabbi comes in and visits and that. And a lot of times, too, that individual who comes in has an individual rabbi that he, you know, has been a member of the temple. So they just come in and visit them on a one-on-one level and that. But the Bible classes and all that kind of stuff, in other words, there again, where's backsliders and all those kind of things, you know? I mean, you've got delinquents. I mean, if you go out and if you expect 100% participation out of your congregation, you better get out of it now because you're going to go crazy. You'd be lucky if you get about a 45% participation. So, I mean, these are people who already believe. I mean, most of them are fundamentalists, though. I mean, that's another thing that we've got to deal with when we come in. And it's also, usually right now, most of the groups that want to come in are fundamentalist groups or Pentecostal types. And that really can screw a lot of guys up, and we've got to go around and, you know, redefine a lot of things for people in terms of their faith and their belief and what it means to be in a relationship with God and what the gospel is really all about. Because, again, most of that is a lot of legalism that comes out. somewhat similar to the way I grew up as a Lutheran. There was a lot of gospel now, but boy, there's a heck of a lot of legalism that was there. And there, in fact, I still feel there still is a lot of strong fold of legalism in our church today. But there again, dealing with the people that come in, and I think to give them some good handles on the faith that they have. Granted, there's a lot of jailhouse, what we call jailhouse religions. You know, I mean, they feel that, well, they know that I've got a certain amount of power in the court, and but they've also, I mean, most of the guys today, the new ones that come through, it's a little bit different. But the guys who've been around and been in and out, you know, and with the recidivism rate and all that, they know they don't have to play games with me to get something accomplished. Like when I first started, the guys would come in, they'd ask for a Bible, ask for prayer, and all those kind of things, and they said, well, can I make a phone call? And I said, well, give me back the Bible, and I'll take back my prayer. Why don't you just ask for a phone call? You know, you don't have to play games with me to get something accomplished. However, there are guys who are really, you know, in searching for some meaning to their lives. And they may have had something in the past, it's been gone, they've tried a variety. But one example of one guy I knew for years, and he was really what we call a real shit disturber when he came to, well, he was that bad on the streets, but when he came into jail, he was just bad news. And, I mean, he would usually rob somebody, rape somebody, file lawsuits, give the correctional officers the trouble and all that kind of stuff. And I'd known Jerome over the years. And the last time he come through, there was a friend of his that, he was locked up, then he escaped, they arrested him up in Chicago. And while he was in Chicago, some Christian people got a hold of him. And he had a conversion experience, a born-again kid that happened. And he came back to jail then and began to share his faith, or his newfound faith, with Jerome. Well, Jerome got interested, and he wanted to learn a little bit more. And he and I know one another over the years. And he would usually, if he'd go to church, it was just to get out of his cell. He never came to Bible class or anything like that, but he got interested in it. He started coming, he wanted to attend the Bible class, and individually we talked many times and all that kind of stuff. He was in on a murder charge. So you figure, okay, I'm waiting for the pitch to come from Jerome. You know, when, you know, will you go over and see what you can do? That never came, and Jerome went over, pled guilty to his charges, and got 50 years in the penitentiary. And he came back from jail. I saw him the day he came back. And he said, Reverend Bynes, for the first time in my life, I am at peace. He said, I've tried it all. You know, he's tried, you know, the Muslims, he tried the black, I forget what group we had here in St. Louis at that time, a very militant type group.
Panthers.
And, well, I don't know, it was the Panthers. I don't think we had them. I forget what we call it, what they were here. But anyhow, he said, I tried all that, and until I found Jesus, you know, I've never had any peace. And, you know, never asked me to hustle and all those kind of things. And ended up, you know, in fact, going to the penitentiary. Then I got a letter back from him. Of course, again, he startled the penitentiary because, again, instead of running around doing what he usually did, he was running around with his Bible and cornering people in the yard and whatnot and said, come here, I want to tell you about Jesus, you know. And he drew the administration wild up there because they didn't know what kind of a game he was playing up there either, but he had a definite change in his life. And I even got letters back from him saying, you got to come up here. These chaplains aren't preaching the gospel. They're not talking about Jesus. They're not, you know, relating that. So I didn't have time to go up there and street on a chaplain either. But I mean, that's the kind of things that happen. I mean, there's very rewarding. And there's other guys who will play games. But again, I don't never really treat it as game because I think they're searching. And I think they're just like anybody else. You know, you take people in your congregation when you get out. Or some of you may have been out. Some of you look about as old as I am. you've got people who go through crisis in their lives, who become very, very deep in their faith and religious beliefs and convictions and all that because of those crises. And when those crises pass, all of a sudden they drift too. You know, they're maybe not as strong, quote, as what the outward kind of a thing in your parish as they may have been before. And that, and those things are normal happenings of one's life. And I don't sell that short at all. You know, most of the stuff in the scripture is deals with crisis time. That's when you go to God. And for me to question then, well, are you just playing games? That's not my job. That's God's job. You know, that's his problem, not my problem. I have to deal with face values of people who come to me and give them everything I possibly can at that particular time. And I deal very basically, you know, the simple creed is my primary mode of operation in terms of relating, you know. Because again, also the men and the images that they have of themselves is usually a very low self-image of themselves. In spite of the fact they may show a very proud type, powerful front, that's for the games that we play in jail. Usually, you know, they got low self-images, and they need to bolster that kind of a thing up. They need some purpose and meaning to their lives, and they need some hope. And you just basically deal with the creation. You know, you are somebody who is very, very important. You know, God called you into being. You don't need the mayor, you don't need the president, somebody else to say, you're okay, because God has already done that. Then you move to the second part of redemption, you know. You're so important, God, you know, bought you back or recreated you twice, as it were, which begins to give some purpose to a person's life. You know, just to share the gospel. Of course, sure, there's the other things in terms of our materialistic life, but the whole purpose of living out one's life to the fullest in the sharing of God's word and gospel with one another and all that, and then the act of sanctification and hope. No matter what, you know, the fear of death and those kind of things are gone because we know what's going to happen to us. There's no uncertainty. And even as we live out our existence, if we stumble and fall or end up as the prodigal son, there's the hope that is there in terms of forgiveness and restoration and picking you back up and moving you along. And those are, again, three strong elements that we constantly deal with while, you know, the men are there. And that, to me, really bolsters people up. It's a whole brand new image of themselves and their relationship to God. And I guess most of my preaching and Bible study work and things like that is how you tie your faith or your God and your belief into your everyday activities. You know, what does it mean to be a believer? What does it mean to have God in your life? And how does that live itself out? So that's, you know, primarily my religious kind of activities, which is quite a little bit of our time.
I guess I have another question.
Okay.
Taking this from a law and then gospel approach, do you have to preach the law that often? Are they pretty well already crushed because they're in jail and their confidence is down and all that?
They're very much aware of the law. They don't... And again, everything in the system negates what we try to do.
Mm-hmm.
You see, there's no forgiveness in the system. There's only punishment. That's, you know, and even it's even worse when you hit the penitentiary. You know, the things that the gospel really relates and stands for is so hard to relate because everything around you is the direct opposite. I mean, the whole system that confined you is a very negative, demeaning kind of a way of life. And rules and regulations and punishments that are constantly meted out, you know, either by the system itself or by just the inmate population. Whereas in a pretrial situation, we don't have it that bad, but then we deal also with the court system, the judicial system, which basically is not a forgiving system. That system is built upon punishment and retribution. That's all there is to it. And there's no way, you know, you can get around that. And two, in a sense, the idea of confession, you know, that's a nasty word when it comes to pretrial. You know, you don't confess to anybody. Don't talk, you know. Well, there's a little phrase, don't talk and you may walk, which is probably very true. I might recommend if you ever get arrested, talk to the police. Talk to a lawyer first. You'd be much better off legally, you know. But, I mean, that kind of a thing. So, in other words, there again, you've got a thing, don't confess, you're wrong. You know, even if you're as good as gold for it, don't talk about it with anybody but your lawyer. So sometimes the guys have a misconception of, let's say, confession and repentance in terms of forgiveness because they identify that so much with the court system and then punishment. But then when you speak forgiveness, that kind of blows their minds, you know, to dealing with that kind of a thing. And again, it's a variable. One guy came in I didn't know him prior to this. He had killed his wife. And he came in, and this happened on a Friday. Therefore, he came into the jail on Monday. I didn't see him till Tuesday when I was making my round. And he was sitting, in fact, I didn't know who he was, even. And he was sitting outside. He was on a lockdown tier, and he was sitting outside. And as I come by, you know, he really looked like he was disturbed. You know, I mean, not mentally disturbed, but upset, I guess is a better word. And he said, oh, can I talk to you? And I said, yeah, do you want to talk to me here, which meant on the tier, or do you want me to call you out into the lobby area where we can have a little more privacy? He said, well, I'd like to talk to you outside. And, okay, I brought him out. And his main question to me, will God forgive me? And then I said, well, you know, reassure him of all of that, and then said, well, why are you in here? Then he related to me, and then I remembered the story from the papers and all that. He ended up, you know, really growing tremendously in terms of his whole, and he was not, quote, what we would call an unbeliever. He was a church member. He belonged to a church on the streets and all those kind of things. And he'd been raised in a Christian home and those, but again, the what we call the backsliding and that kind of stuff. And, but his whole growth process of understanding and an awareness of God in his life and what all that really meant. I haven't heard back from him. I'm a little bothered by that. He's gone to the penitentiary. He's got 50 years, no probation, no parole, which means he'll probably do the rest of his life in the penitentiary. He was like 37. That means he's going to be about 57 or 87 when he gets out, if he lives that long. I haven't heard back from him, and I wish I would, because I don't know really what's going on, and I sure hope he maintains himself. I'm sure that he will. But again, just the change that took place in this guy's life, in his deepening of his understanding. He, again, almost from the first one, he came into the jail. He was in my Bible class. You know, never missed a night. He was there every time. Witnessing on his tier, gathering people together, and it was really a stronghold on that tier, because we had about four guys coming off that tier, and it was through his, I think, insistence and whatnot, saying, hey, you got to go to Bible class and church. And after he left, then I had about four of those guys backslide, you know, then too, then they dropped out. But I mean, he really was a person who believed and was willing to carry it out, you know. So those kind of things happen quite frequently. And there's others who, you know, again, could care less. And just like any place else.
How long have you been in ministry? Not necessarily.
Oh, 25 years total. Yeah, I just celebrated my 25th anniversary this past, July last year is when I graduated in 61.
My question would be, before that time, regardless of how strong you may have been your faith, I'm sure that you've grown through that time, but being involved with the prison setting, I'm sure has had an effect on your life, and I was wondering how you've dealt with that, because that would be a great difference from before you were involved in prison ministry, and how you've been able to keep their wrong ways out of your life. Through that time.
This was asking me, I guess, there was an article done on me in the Riverfront Times last year. It's basically my faith. I believe that. I mean, what I say, I believe. And I don't find my setting any different than somebody else's. I mean, it's the people of God who are in need of that constant encouragement and power of his word and sacrament.
I'm sure that people respect you with the fact that they know that you're a pastor, but do you get exposed to bad language? I'm sure that you do every day.
I use it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That's, I guess, another common kind of thing, not only of the jail, but even of the courthouse. We would probably be categorized somewhere around Luther, the way he talked. He was not the nicest guy in the world either when it comes to his language, I guess. But yeah, I mean, you're exposed to a variety of things. And the big thing is, though, too, is that, even I tell the students who work with me, is that you got to remain non-judgmental. You can't go in as judge. That's not our job. It's not my job to judge a person's guilt or innocence. It's my job to relate to him the gospel, God's love and forgiveness, and the power of this God in his life. If he goes to court, again, I don't assure people that, hey, if you believe in Jesus, you're going to hit 14th Street. That means that's the street that runs in front of the jail on the outside, you know, that you're getting free. But one of the strongest things that we also have to deal with, because again, most of my guys go to the penitentiary, is that God is every place. I mean, he's not restricted. And to really hope that that dawns on them and it really sinks in and it gets through and that becomes a part of their faith life. Because a lot of times we use gimmicks, you know. I've used them in my life. You know, I lost my brother's knife one time. Oh, God, I promised him the moon if he'd just help me find that knife. Consequently, I never found the knife, and I'm still alive today. My brother didn't kill me, and those kind of things. But, I mean, as was a child growing up, and I still think even as adults, we sometimes do those mental gymnastics where we make deals with God. I'll do this and do that if you just get me out of here and all that. But then again, it's putting a proper perspective of what one's faith means. One faith is not necessarily freedom from behind these bars. But it's freedom, let's say, from the devil, the world, and our own sinful flesh. You know, that kind of freedom, which is altogether different than being, you know, quote, free, because like we say down there, there's many people on the streets that are more confined than what you guys are, even though they're, quote, in a free world. That's another struggle that we go through, because a lot of times, and again, from the fundamental ideas, it has to be done. But, you know, the situation at the jail, I mean, I started out in a parish for 5 years. I was down in southern Illinois in Sparta, which is about 60 miles southeast of here. From there, I came back to a specialized ministry, which was a downtown ministry in St. Louis here, where we dealt with the economic or business world, the political world, and I dealt very heavily with the black community at that time, too. And I was in that for 5 years. I was in experimental ministry. And just when we figured out exactly what was going on, after we tried and tested and really, you know, knew where we wanted to go and all that, our beloved church shut it down, which really frogged me off. And then 6 months later, the guy I worked with, which was the United Church of Christ minister, he and I were in the downtown ministry together. Then they also shut his down. His was legitimate because of funds, because they also were supporting the building and all that. But we even tried to convince them to keep it going aside from the building, and they didn't. And of course, I was stopped too. Then I went over to Transfiguration in the city and filled in there. And then the chaplain that was at the jail and the workhouse and whatnot retired. And the Lutheran Mission Association has always had a jail ministry, but we don't double up. In other words, if somebody's there, we don't say, well, we got to be there too. And when he retired, then they asked if I would fill in till the Interchurch Association decided what they were going to do. Well, then they folded in 71, and then LMA called me to be the chaplain, and I accepted, and I've been there ever since. So, yeah, I'm finished 17 years this year. And I like it. I enjoy it. It's just like a parish, you know. You have your ups and your downs, your days when you just do not be in that ministry. And there's different drawbacks to it, and there's different pluses to it. One thing coming from a parish, you do miss children, where children can be a lot of fun up until the eighth grade. And eighth grade time, you can dig out. Like, I'll never do any more confirmation camps. I think those kids are... but youth groups after that, I also was in that ministry in southern Illinois, and then also here at in St. Louis. I worked as a part-time at Zion out in Ferguson, and had the youth ministry there and evangelism committee, and then preached on Sundays.
I was intrigued when you talked of preaching the gospel in a structure so full of law. I'm not certain what I want to ask, but I guess I wonder how you handle that. When do you say to the inmates that it should be different here or something? Or is that where you're addressing that? But, I mean, do you think the prison system and the court system could be anything other than just punitive law?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, we've been working hard to do some changes in that area, especially in regard to sentencing. Statistically, for 20 years, our penitentiary system has batted zero. I mean, it's been a total failure. And yet we maintain it to the tune of billions of dollars each year. I also believe there are people who have to be confined. There are those people who cannot live in a free society. However, their confinement, they should also be dealt with. And that we're not doing. And what that also means is that that's about 10% of our prison population right now. In other words, there's 90% that I feel that are in prison that could be dealt with in an altogether different way, in a rehabilitative way, in an alternative way, at a less cost and a more of a return on our money from the product that we're dealing with. And that can be done in a variety. But also, just to maybe get back to your other thing, in my contrast to that, you know, we do that, I do that, one, in terms of how does God deal with us, to understand that. And that is not necessarily man's way. It's definitely not the court system's way. But then you also break it down one more, is that it usually is not our way. Usually you and I are not willing to forgive. Usually you and I want revenge, or I'm going to get you, rather than forgiveness and restoration. So, you know, to put it all in perspective, not just to hammer at the negativisms that are in the courts that we find, but also the negativisms basically in our world and in our own personal lives. So we get an understanding of that, of how we have to operate if we're going to begin to change anything else around us, and that our own lives, first of all. But above all, to understand God's grace and forgiveness, you know, that is there in spite of what man does. So there again, so that understanding is there. Now, we can't guarantee what man will do to you, but we can guarantee what God will do to you. And the big removal of fear of death is a big thing, because that is the big club that legalism hangs over everybody's head, whether it's street justice, penitentiary justice, or man's justice in the courts. That's the big thing they hang over people's heads. And, you know, God removes that completely from one's life, as far as I'm concerned, as far as me. I could care less. I worry a little bit about how I'm going to go, but going is no real problem. And to get that kind of a thing, then that frees you up to live and be who God intended you to be. So you constantly break it down in all levels so we get an understanding of that. It's not just that they operate that way, but we also operate the same way many times in our lives. So, you know, there again, that constant need of God and His gospel, that constant need of our lives to be lived in forgiveness, that constant need of a restoration that we have with one another, and that has to be going on constantly. And that is, you know, how we do it. As far as the penal system is concerned, last year, no, in 85, I guess it was, myself and the Catholic Criminal Justice Ministry, which consists of two sisters and a priest, we work very closely together in terms of our area. We started what we call the client-specific planning. In other words, usually the system only looks at the prior criminal record of somebody. That's the determining factor. If you read the editorial page this morning, the sentencing structures that they just came out with for the federal government to, quote, be equal. I mean, to me, this is ridiculous that you get lumped into, you know, a grid. You know, where do you fit on the grid? You know, it's going to determine whether you get 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, or whatever there is. The main thing behind what we were trying to do, in which we were able to accomplish, and now this is part of the public defender's office, we brought it into being, we got volunteers and all that kind of stuff to work it, to prove it up, and then finally it was always worked through the public defender's office. Now they have actually hired a person to do this, part of this in their whole system. But what it does primarily is looks at the social history of the individual. Who is this person in terms of his needs, in terms of his problems or her problem, his or her. I deal with females as well. Does they have alcohol problems, drug problems, educational problems? Do they need employment or employment skills and those kind of things? In other words, to look at that person in that total perspective, then to sit down and plug in, community resources to the needs or to the problems that that person has, and begin to, quote, bring it back into a restoration kind of a thing, rather than to send a person on to the penitentiary. Because when he comes back from the penitentiary, they're going to be worse than what you sent them. That's a given. We know that for sure. The only rehabilitation that takes place in the penitentiary is an individual who's got enough will to get through it without becoming too scarred and want to do something with his life when he comes back out again, or her life.
How prevalent is this knowledge throughout the system that it's failed?
It's been known as long as I've been around.
Administration and all.
Oh, the whole crime commission that was done during Kennedy's administration. I mean, wrapped it something fierce.
So is there a thirst for change or anything?
No, there's not. That's everybody has this concept of law and order. But they fail to understand how the law and order can be accomplished, I think, through forgiveness. You see, even the circuit attorney downtown is almost afraid to get victims and defendants together. And you know why? Out of his mouth to me, he said, well, they may forgive them, and it's going to be harder to prosecute. Out of his own mouth, a good Christian boy. I mean, stop and think about that for a minute. There's ways that we can deal with this, but again, the way politicians get elected, wait and see when election time comes around. You're going to find the politician is going to get hard on crime. He's going to promise stiffer sentences. If you're in a state where they don't have a death penalty, they're going to push for a death penalty for anything. And they'll usually take the popular causes. Murder, of course, one. But then maybe even into child sex molestations. Well, that's a big one. Hang those so-and-sos, But I mean, that's the way that we deal. That's what we, and again, the concept is that the community wants that. And I would say most of the time, the majority of our community wants that. If I get, something happened to me, I would want to know, A, who that person is. I want that person to know who I am. And I would like to get together with him and have some form of restitution given back to me, as well as a restoration of him and me together. The whole Old Testament concept was built on that. It was not necessarily that we removed people from the community. Everything that they tried to do was to bring that person back into the community and restore them. Now, if this person absolutely refused to repent, it's almost like we use our excommunication. You've already excommunicated or excluded yourself from this community. And that, is something that we have not done in our system. Our system is immediately to remove them. And I guess one of the other things that is in direct opposition, as I see it, to the gospel, is that it's exclusive. And the gospel is never exclusive. It's always been inclusive. Nobody is to be left out. I mean, the whole idea and the concept of the church and the body that Paul speaks of, You know, I can't say to the eye, I don't need you, or I can't say to the foot, we don't need you. And if one part suffers, all suffer. And that is a concept that we haven't really come to grips with in terms of our legal system.
Well, when you were talking about the Old Testament, they tried all they could to bring them back into the people, and then otherwise then they're excommunicated. Does that, if you were to apply that to the prison system now, is that the 10% that can't do it?
No, yeah, the 10% would be the ones that can't do it right now. But, see, like I said, the problem is those guys really need some help.
Are they criminally insane?
No, they're just, well, it depends, I guess, on how you define criminally insane.
Yeah.
They're just bad actors. But the problem that you got is those suckers are the ones who run the penitentiary. See, administrations and guards and all that do not run penitentiaries. Inmates run penitentiaries. And don't ever kid yourself. I mean, I visited Church Farm one day, a population of, 700, I think, at that time. Do you know how many correctional officers they had there? For 700 people? 5, and 2 of them were gone. Who runs that institution? The inmates run it. And that's usually run, again, on the same standard. Power and fear. Good question.
What stance have you personally taken, or does the clergy and in positions like yourself take on capital punishment? I'm not from St. Louis, I've just moved here, and I don't know exactly what state of Missouri stance is. Do they have capital punishment?
I am opposed to capital punishment in any shape, way, or form. I don't believe anybody has the right to kill except God. And I mean by that, I cannot sanction David killing his wife, nor can I sanction the state if he would have gotten the death penalty to kill him. However, our beloved Synod is in favor of the death penalty, which they've tried at a number of conventions to eliminate. In fact, the last one up in Indiana, where wherever it was,
Indianapolis,
there was again resolutions to be opposed to the death penalty, but the official position of the Synod is still that they okay the death penalty. I am personally opposed to it, and I basically could care less right now with Synod things on it. I mean, we'll work to try to get their ideas changed too. But I just don't believe man has the right to take another man's life. In fact, what really upsets me is that under the guise of law and politically right and legally right, right now we've got a young man, he's a little older than I am, in a penitentiary who has got 2 murders. Three assistant circuit attorneys and the head circuit attorney sat together and basically said this man should die. They will not even permit him. He's willing to plead guilty. He's made his confession. He's made his repentance. He's asked for forgiveness, etc., etc., etc. He would have been willing, when he first came through, just because of his contrition, to have pled guilty to the death penalty. Since, again, we've been working again with him, reassuring him again of maybe some of the misconceptions he has about God and how God deals with us, feels that, okay, I'll take my punishment, and he would plead guilty, and he's willing to spend the rest of his life in the penitentiary, which is basically the alternative to the death penalty. They will not even permit him to plead guilty to life in the penitentiary. They want his death. And I think that's wrong. I think that's just like Al Capone sitting with his henchmen saying, let's go out and kill Moscone. I think it's just as wrong. To me, that is a direct plot to take another person's life. And it fits under the statute of capital murder.
Well,
but it's done legally. And I just, you know, and again, most of the capital murder trials in the city are based, or they go to trial because they won't give them the alternative. And a lot of times, too, I feel a lot of our capital murderers, even under the law, are overcharged. And again, you got all kinds of strikes against you when you go to a capital murder trial. First of all, the whole jury has to say, I'll give him the death penalty. And that makes, you know, your cards are stacked against you, you know, when you go in there as a defense attorney. Because you've got 12 people who already can say, I can give the death penalty. And anybody who says, I can't, you're stricken. So, and again, the whole other thing, it was just the Supreme Court overruled. I mean, the indiscriminate use of it in terms of the blacks that are being killed or put, you know, who received the death penalty as versus whites and all that. They proved it up all the way through. And yet the Supreme Court says, well, that's okay. Now, you can imagine what that does to the country that you live in, especially if you're non-white. And, you know, the whole, the racism that is going on today are still, I mean, not that it's ever stopped, but the racism causes a crime, racism, unemployment, education, and housing. That's causes a crime. Again, also, you're usually into those factors, too. Drugs play a very prominent part. I would say 80% of the crime that you read about in the paper, what we call street crime, is directly drug or alcohol related. Some chemical dependence is there. And that's another real huge problem that we haven't even begun to deal with. And this new drug they got out, this water, PCP, is a mind-boggling drug. I mean, these guys don't even know what they're doing. And they also become violent with it. And that's where a lot of these child abuse cases are coming from, too.
Well, officially we end at 11:50.
Oh, okay.
Unless you want to go on, we have to release some people. But first, we'd like to say thank you, Pastor Bynes, for coming. I don't even think we said your name when you came in. So I feel kind of bad, but I'm glad that you came. Thank you.
Thank you.